crane my neck this way, then that, looking at a man scooping hot popcorn into a paper cone, next to a barber lathering an old man's face, next to a boy plucking the feathers from a lifeless chicken, next to an ear cleaner, his customer grunting with satisfaction, next to a woman whose arms are draped with 100 necklaces, next to a man with a flute coaxing a snake out of a basket, next to a tailor pumping the treadles of his sewing machine, next to a bone seller rattling his wares, next to a woman with a basket heaped with dates, next to a pig nosing through a pile of trash, next to a boy ladling oil out of a tin, next to a man selling broken pieces of motorcycles, next to a girl threading marigolds on a string, next to a man with crates of pigeons for sale, next to a woman serving tea, next to a boy shining shoes, next to a water buffalo napping in the shade, next to a man selling cucumbers, next to a man chanting a prayer, next to a man scooping hot popcorn into a paper cone. And I wonder, in this swarming, hurry-up city, what will happen next to me? On the bus. The cart we are riding on now is called a bus. I don't know this for certain, but I am fairly sure that this is its name because Auntie said, "Don't pester me with 1,000 questions when we get on the bus." Here is what I know so far. The carts with chicken and sheep in the back are called trucks. The ones with people inside are cars. A fire inside makes them go. People here live in solid wall huts that are stacked on top of each other. City people are not angry at each other. They don't greet one another because they don't know each other. The bus has soft benches, and it holds a village full of people. It smells of onions and curry and cigarette smoke, and a baby who has soiled his cloth, and other things I cannot name. The man next to me empties his nose out the window, pinching one side shut and blowing on the other, and for a moment I am afraid that I will lose my meal again. Auntie is asleep, her head drooping heavily on my shoulder. I don't move. I look out the window. A man with a table strapped to his back is walking down the middle of the road. The bus bleats, and the man scuttles out of the way like a lizard darting into its hole. A cow is sleeping in the middle of the road. The bus goes around her. Another bus with another village full of people comes straight toward us, then slips off to our side and passes by in a rush of wind. At first I nearly cry out, but then I look around at stone faces of the city people and understand that that is not done here. I study the scene in front of the bus the way I studied my letters in school. Gradually I begin to make out a kind of order in all the disorderliness, a pattern to it all. It is like a river, where the currents of buses and trucks and people and animals flow into and around each other. If you look hard enough, chaos turns into order the way letters turn into words. This city is not so hard. You just have to study it. Auntie is right. I'll do well here. Seeing a girl with a long black braid. There are 1,000 girls in the city, but so far, none of them is Gita. Lost. I do not understand. The bus has left the city, and we are traveling on a hard black road. Everyone on the bus is asleep. No matter which way I turn, I cannot see the swallow-tailed peak. More questions. When the sun comes up, the people on the bus begin to stir. A man with a rooster in a metal basket throws a cloth over it, but the old bird cannot be fooled. He announces the new day insistently. When Auntie wakes up, I ask her why we are no longer in the city. She tells me not to worry. "That was just a small city," she says. "We are going to a much bigger city, a grand city, a city by the water." I take some comfort in her words. This explains why the roofs in the first city were not covered in gold. But I am also worried. If there are two cities, which one is Gita in? New clothes. We have driven through a half dozen cities and have arrived at a strange solid wall hut with many rooms. The family here seems to have many armors, a few men but no children. Auntie takes me into one of the rooms. There is nothing in it but a stained straw mat. "Take off those filthy hill clothes," she says. It is immodest to undress in the presence of another, and so I wait for Auntie to leave. But she clucks her tongue like an angry hen and tells me I will have to get over my backward country ways. Then she holds out a pink dress of cloud fabric and a pair of shoes. "For me?" I say. She clucks again and says, "We haven't got all day." I walk to the corner, turn my back to her, wriggle out of my own clothes, then lift the soft pink petticoat over my head. The new dress seems to be one long piece of cloth, with no beginning and no end, material so light and fine, I feel more naked than dressed inside it. Auntie turns me to face her. I cover myself with my hands, but Auntie pries them away, saying I am a hopeless rube. She wraps the fabric once around my waist, then once more, twists and tucks it in at my hip. I cannot imagine how I will walk freely in such a long, flowing gown, or how I will be able to hold the firewood and scrub the floors in such a fine and flimsy dress. Auntie points to the shoes. "These go on your feet," she says. I want her to know that I know about shoes, that I had a pair of sandals when my father was alive. But my feet, bare and tough and dirty from 3 days of travel, would make my words seem like lies. So I put the shoes on, as if I do so every day. Instantly, my feet howl. These shoes are nothing but tight little boxes. I clench my toes, like a bat grasping a branch, as I stuff my old homespun clothes into my bundle and try to keep up with Auntie as she hurries from the room. Numbers. Auntie is speaking to a man in a tongue I do not understand. Some of the words are familiar, but most of them rush by, like the huts and shops and huts and shops, making my head hurt from the speed of this city talk. It seems as though they are talking about me now. The man, who has a nose like a turnip, points to me and asks Auntie a question. The answer, as best I can tell, is the number 12. He trains his eyes on me and my pink dress, and I imagine that he can see right through it. I wrap my arms around myself.
"How old are you?"
he says in my language. I tell him I am 13. He wheels around and slaps Auntie across the face, and she turns from a woman of queenly bearing to a frightened child. The turnip-nosed man lets out a stream of angry words I cannot follow, but I understand that I have done wrong. I fall to my knees and beg the man to forgive me. But he and Auntie are laughing. They are speaking in a strange language, but it seems that they are trading numbers. Auntie names a price as high as a mountain. The man spits. Auntie names another figure. The turnip-nosed man answers with a smaller amount. Auntie goes high. The man goes low. Eventually they agree, and the man gives Auntie a roll of rupee notes. I do not know what they have agreed to. But I do know this. He gives her nearly enough money to buy a water buffalo. Uncle Husband. Auntie has gone, leaving me in the room with a turnip-nosed man. I have never been alone with a man who is not in my family. I pull my shawl over my head and hide inside the pink cloud fabric. But the man comes close, so close I can smell the sour stink of his hair oil. He smiles, reaches in his pocket, and offers me a sweet. I do not want to cross this slapping man, so I take it. "When will Auntie return?" I ask.
"Bimla," the man says.
I do not know her proper name. I only know her as Auntie. I shrug, yes, no, I don't know.
"Don't worry," he says. "You will see your Auntie Bimla again after we cross the border."
I don't know this word, border, but I have learned from Auntie that city people don't like to be asked a lot of questions.
"From now on," he says, "I will be your uncle, but you must call me husband. Do you understand?"
I don't, not at all, but I nod.
The Buddha is a very dangerous place, he says. There are bad men there, men with guns, men who might harm you or try to take you away from me and Auntie.
It is all so confusing. I am afraid of this man, but I also feel grateful that he will protect me from the bad Buddha men with guns.
Don't be frightened, he says kindly. It is a pretend game. You like games, don't you?
I nod. Gita and I used to play pretend games. When we played make-believe, I sometimes had a husband. But it was Krishna, the young goatherd with sleepy cat eyes, not an old turnip-nosed man who doles out sweets and slaps with the same hand. Crossing the border. The cart we are travelling in now is called a rickshaw. It is pulled by a chicken-legged man in a rag skirt. Uncle Husband and I sit on a seat in the back, while all around us are carts of every kind, spewing smoke and churning dust. Our rickshaw sits in a long line of trucks and cars going nowhere while people on foot pass by. One of those people is Auntie. I place my palms together to greet her. Then I remember the city lesson I have learned and let my hands fall back in my lap as I watch her thread her way through the crowd. Uncle Husband leans close and slips a sweet into my palm.
You like sweets, don't you? He says.
During the hungry months, I've eaten porridge thickened with dirt, rotten potatoes, boiled weeds. I nod. I like sweets. I like them more than I can say. I nod and then remember to whisper, thank you. Up ahead, I see one of the bad border men. He is dressed all in tan, and he has a gun at his hip. He stops each cart and asks questions. Uncle Husband puts an arm around my shoulder.
Don't be afraid, he says. I will take care of you.
The border man steps up to our cart. He and Uncle Husband speak in quick city talk, examining an important-looking piece of paper that Uncle Husband has taken from his vest. The border man points to the paper and asks me,
Is this your husband?
I curl my toes inside my new shoes and say, Yes. The man places a hand on his hip, and I wait for him to shoot me for this lie. But he simply walks on to the next cart. Soon we are moving, the feet of the rickshaw puller padding noiselessly on the dirt path. I ask Uncle Husband when we will cross the border. He says we already have. A reward. Uncle says I have done well, and he gives me a handful of sweets. I eat one and store the others in my bundle. He yells at the chicken-legged man, cursing at him and telling him to go faster. Next time Uncle is in a good mood, I will ask him where I can find a mail runner to take the rest of the sweets back home to Amma. Train. Now we are riding on a train. It makes thunder when it moves, but somehow it rocks the people inside to sleep. Uncle takes a flat pouch from his vest, puffs his cheeks out, and blows into it. The thing fills slowly with his breath, and soon it takes the shape of a giant lentil bean. Then he puts it behind his head and closes his eyes. When he wakes up, I will ask him when we will see Auntie again. In the meantime, I am writing in my notebook about the strange things I have seen so far. All the houses here have glass suns like the one in Gita's hut, and the men carry devices that trill like birds and cause them to shout, Hello! Hello! And everywhere I look, there are pictures of beautiful, full-hipped women and handsome men with glossy hair. I am not sure, but I think they must be movie stars. Since we crossed the border, everything is different, even the language on the signs.
We are in India now, Uncle Husband has told me. Don't speak to anyone here. If they hear you talk, they will know you're from the mountains, and they will try to take advantage of you.
But while he's sleeping, I write a few of these India words in my notebook. Maybe if my wealthy mistress is pleased with my work, she would teach me what they mean. When I have run out of words to copy, I look out the window at this strange place called India. Inside the train, the people around me are snoring. I don't understand how they can close their eyes when there is so much to see. 100 rotis. The train has stopped at a giant metal hut. Through the window, I can see a man with a grill stacked with 100 rotis. People run from the train and line up at his cart. His mountain of bread begins to disappear. My stomach churns, looking at so much food vanishing so fast. Uncle Husband tells me to stay in my seat. Then he joins a line of people at the cart. Soon he comes back to the train with a steaming roti, fragrant with home and ama. I go weak with wanting.
For you, he says.
I go weak with gratitude. Uncle Husband isn't young and handsome like Krishna, and I can never tell when he might grow angry and slap me. But I am grateful, in this strange new world of moving thunder and invisible borders, that he is my Uncle Husband. City Ways. The train slows to a halt. Uncle Husband tells me to stand up, that we are making a stop. I don't understand. Still, I am glad of the chance to get out of this traveling oven and move my legs. We leave the train, and I see that the men are going to one side, women to another. Uncle Husband puts a hand to my cheek. His touch is soft. His words are hard.
Come right back. Don't try anything, or your family will not see a single rupee.
I swallow, nod, and join the river of women flowing into a field beside the train. Then, all around me, the women lift their skirts, squat like crows, and relieve themselves on the open ground. I feel shame for them, doing in front of others what is rightly done in private. And I am almost ill, as the odor of so much waste swirls around me. But my own need for relief is so strong, I have no choice but to do as they do. I copy their crow pose, but somehow I wet a corner of my long, flowing dress. Now my shame is for myself. Disgraced. As I walk back to the train, I pass a cluster of men yelling and shaking their fists in the air. At the center of the group, a girl my age crouches in the dirt. Her scalp has been freshly shaved, pale and fragile as a bird's egg, and hanks of her long dark hair lie in coils at her feet. One of the men in the crowd throws his cigarette butt at her feet. Another one spits in her direction. Then another, a fat old man with a boil on his neck, picks up a handful of gravel and flings it at her. She winces, then begins to cry. I see Uncle Husband standing at the edge of the circle, puffing on a cigarette, taking in the scene with untroubled eyes. I run over to his side.
"What is happening?" I ask. "What did she do to deserve this kind of punishment?"
He grinds his cigarette out with his boot and sighs.
"That's what she gets," he says, "for trying to run away from her husband."
He points to the old man with a boil on his neck. The old husband's cheeks are flushed with pride now as he grabs the girl by the arm and leads her away. She's squirming and crying, dragging her feet in the dirt.
"Stupid girl," says Uncle Husband.
I don't understand.
"One look at that head of hers and anyone can tell she's a disgraced woman," he says. "Even if she does run off again, no one will help her."
A city of the dead. The sun is not yet up when Uncle Husband tells me that we've reached our destination. As the train glides to a stop, I hold my bundle close and look out the window for the golden roofs. What I see first is one hut, sway-backed as an old water buffalo. Then another and another, until there is nothing but hut after hut after hut after hut. There are roofs made of metal scraps, held down with the soft black wheels from cars. There are roofs of heavy paper, piled with bricks and boots and pots and pans. And roofs made of sheets, tied in place with plastic vines. But no roofs of gold. No date or mango or orange trees. And no movie stars. Only rows of sleeping bodies. Side by side by side are men, women and children in rags, asleep on the ground. I try to count them, get to 200 and give up when I see 200 more beyond them. Uncle husband says to stay close as we get off the train. Outside, the air is warm and heavy, thick with the smoke of 100 cooking fires. The sky is so choked with dust that the light from the electric suns on poles disappears in the haze. All around us, people shuffle along, heads down, eyes empty, as the dust churns at their feet. I am afraid of this city, where the lying down people look like the dead, and the standing up ones like the walking dead. Walking in the city. It is hard to walk in my new shoes, harder still to push through streets jammed with scrawny rickshaw men, hauling plump passengers, naked children pawing through rubbish heaps, stray dogs nosing through gutters filled with human waste. At one street corner, two boys are begging for coins. One has a leg that ends in a stump where his knee should be. He cups his hand and brings it to his mouth, as if he is eating invisible food. The other has a music-making machine. He wears one glove and does a dance that makes it look as if he's walking, even though he's not going anywhere. The people drop their coins in the dancing boy's cup, avoiding the hungry eyes of the other one. A man in baggy trousers twists the tail of his water buffalo to make him go faster. Uncle husband presses his fist into my back to make me go faster. Happiness House. Finally, we turn down an alley and arrive in front of a metal gate held fast with a heavy chain. Uncle takes a key from his vest, opens the lock, and hurries me inside. "Will Auntie be here?" I say.
"Who?"
He is distracted, locking the chain behind us. "Auntie Bimla," I say. "Will she be here?"
"Later," he says. "She'll be here later."
Beyond the gate, a man lies sleeping in front of a door. Uncle nudges him with the toe of his boot. The man rises, lets us in, then locks the door behind us. This place is dark as a cave, and it smells of liquor and incense. As my eyes adjust, I see a dozen sleeping girls, some in the corners, some on rope cots. "What kind of place is this?" I ask Uncle.
"Happiness House," he says. "Auntie Mumtaz will explain it all to you."
In the weak morning light, I see that the girls are wearing dresses of every color. They have heavy silver bangles on their wrists and ankles, and earrings of gold and jewels. Their eyes are painted with black crayon, and their lips are drawn on like red chilies. At home, these girls would be up at dawn to do their chores, not sleeping in their festival clothes until the midday meal. I wonder if perhaps this Happiness House is where the movie stars live. 10,000 rupees. A figure rises from the corner and steps toward us. She has the reed-thin body of a girl and the hollow cheeks of an old woman. She is, under the folds of her yellow dress, frail as a baby bird. Uncle speaks with her in brisk city language, and the aging bird girl disappears behind a curtain. Moments later, the cloth is drawn back. Inside a darkened chamber, a fat woman in a purple sari lounges on a cot. She has folds of flesh like roti dough at her waist, and a face as plump as an overripe mango. She snaps her fingers, and the bird girl flinches. Even Uncle Husband seems to draw back. He pushes me toward the fat mango woman, so close that I can see the bloom of hair on her upper lip. I stand upright, so she can see what a strong worker I am. She surveys me head to toe, then spits.
"How much?" she says to Uncle Husband. 15,000, he says.
The woman laughs.
"For this one, she is thin as yesterday's tea."
They bargain back and forth, sometimes in my language, sometimes in another tongue. Uncle goes high, the woman goes low. Eventually, Uncle shrugs and gives up. The woman takes a record book out from inside the folds of her dress. She writes down the number 10,000. The woman snaps her fingers, and the bird girl rises and takes me by the arm. I look to Uncle Husband.
"Go on," he says impatiently. "She will find you a bed."
I am afraid to leave Uncle Husband, who protected me from the bad border men and brought me a roti, and who is the only person I know in this strange dead city. But I obey, pulling my bundle to my chest and following the girl down a hallway. She takes me upstairs to a tiny room, unlocks the door, and gestures for me to enter. "My Auntie Bimla is coming for me," I tell her. "When she comes to the door, will you tell her I am here?" I cannot tell if the girl understands. She doesn't answer. She simply closes the door. I don't know why I am in this strange house or where Auntie Bimla is. It seems as though this Auntie Mumtaz is my new mistress. She is a strict one, to be sure, but I will prove myself to her. And then my mother will have a new dress, shoes for the cold season, even a new shawl made of the finest yarn. My little brother will have fruit and cods twice a day and a jacket of yak fur. Even my stepfather can get new spectacles and a vest, I suppose. And our roof, our new tin roof, will be the shiniest one on the mountainside. This is what I am thinking as I hear the girl lock the door behind her. In this room, there are posters of gods and movie stars on the walls. An electric sun hanging from the middle of the ceiling. A rope bed. A palm frond machine that stirs the air. And iron bars on the windows. A corner of the room is curtained off with a length of cloth from an old sari. On the floor, a plastic bucket sits next to a hole in the floor. I can tell from the stink that this is the privy. I sit on the bed and try to picture Tali's little pink nose, the mists dancing around the swallow-tailed peak, the tawny grain fields, Amma's crow-black hair, Krishna's sleepy cat eyes. But my thoughts spin like the palm frond machine. I think of the aging bird girl and wonder why she is so skinny if she eats sweet cakes and dates and oranges and mangoes every day. I think of the woman with the rolls of roti dough at her waist and wonder why she lives in this darkened cave building if she is so rich, and if she will teach me city words when I am finished with my chores. But finally my eyes grow heavy, and I lie down on the bed. And after 4 days of travelling, I fall asleep. Homesick. I awake for a moment, unsure of where I am. I yawn and wait for the scent of hearth smoke and baking bread. And what greets my nose is the stench of the privy hall next to my bed. I pray for a mountain breeze, brisk with the promise of snow, and instead I see the palm frond machine lazily churning the same sultry city air. I listen for the clucking of the hens. What I hear are the fighting voices of a man and woman in the room next to mine. So far, this city is not what I had hoped. Perhaps if I close my eyes and fall asleep again, I can at least dream of home. TV. I awake when two girls come and unlock the door. One is pretty, with teardrop eyes and deep brown skin like the hide of a nut. The other has a crooked face. Her right cheek is sunken, and the corner of her mouth is tugged down in a permanent half frown. They take me to a room where the other girls have gathered. The aging bird girl is there, as well as others. Young ones dress to look old, and old ones dress to look young. A naked baby sleeps on a blanket on the floor, and a little girl in pigtails kneels at her mother's feet as she checks her scalp for lice. There is no chatter or laughter like there is when the village women gather. Instead, they are all entranced by a black box with a large glass window in front. Inside the box, a tiny woman is singing. She is wearing gold pants, and her hair is blowing in the wind. The half-frowning girl pushes a button, and the woman is gone. A man sits at a table, reading from a paper. She pushes the button again and again, and the picture inside the box changes again and again. There is a woman scrubbing a pot, shaking her head. Then there is a man hitting a ball with a paddle. Then a schoolgirl drinking Coca-Cola. then back to the woman in the gold pants. A man with slicked back hair whispers in the woman's ear. She puts a finger to his lips, then dances to the corner of the box and disappears. I put my hand to my mouth and wait to see what will happen next. The girl with the nut-brown skin leans toward me. "It's a television," she says in my language. "TV." I have heard about television. My stepfather says his brother received one as a dowry when his son married a wealthy girl. There are no golden roofs here, but perhaps this city is a grand one after all, if every house has a TV. A city girl. The fat woman in the purple sari walks into the room. The girl with the crooked face jumps up and turns off the TV. The dark-skinned girl sits and waits while the others saunter away. The fat woman asks angry questions in the city language. "Yes, Mumtaz," says the dark-skinned girl. "No, Mumtaz," says the frowning girl. This Mumtaz pinches the skin above my elbow and twists it until my eyes sting. I don't move. I don't say a word, even when she lets go and shoves me toward the other girls. Then Mumtaz is gone, and the dark-skinned girl is washing my face, the half-frowning one brushing my hair. They do not speak, and I feel shy around these bold city girls, as they do for me what only my armor has done before. "What are you doing?" I say. The dark-skinned girl starts to answer, but the frowning one tells her to shush and yanks the brush through my hair. She opens a tin box and removes a small bottle of red liquid. Then she takes my hand and paints the liquid on my nails, while the other girl uses a black crayon and draws on my eyelids. "What is happening?" I say. They don't answer. The dark girl, the one who explained to me about the TV, says, "Shh." Then, when the frowning girl turns away, she whispers in my language, "You'll know soon enough." I see my face reflected in a silver glass on the wall. Another Lakshmi looks back at me. She has black-rimmed tiger eyes, a mouth red as a pomegranate, and flowing hair like the tiny gold pants woman in the TV. She is fancy, like Auntie Bimla, like a movie star, like these other city girls. I smile at this new Lakshmi, and she smiles back, uncertainly. Old man. Mumtaz studies me.
"Are you ready to go to work?" she says in my language.
I nod and say yes, then nod again, although I do not understand how these city people do their chores in such fine clothes and uncomfortable shoes. I follow Mumtaz down a hallway lined with tiny rooms. We pass by girls sitting cross-legged on the floor, girls drawing on tiger eyes, girls spraying themselves with flower water. Some of them stare at me, some take no notice. We go up some stairs, down another hallway, then into a room where an old man is lying on a bed. His skin is yellow, and he has tufts of hair poking out from his ears. Mumtaz speaks kindly to him, and I wonder if he is sick. Across the hall, in another room, where a red cloth is hung across the doorway, I hear the sound of grunting. It is a strange animal sound that makes me shudder. Mumtaz points to me and says something to the old man. He licks his palm and smooths down his hair. They do not seem to notice the grunting. Then it stops. The red cloth is pulled back, and a man stands in the hallway, zipping his pants. I look down at my red-painted nails and my new shoes. Something is not right here. I don't know what is going on, but it is not right, not right at all. Mumtaz parts the edge of the bed and tells me to come closer. The old man makes a clucking sound.
"Don't be afraid," she says. "Come here, now."
I don't move. Her voice turns hard.
"Get over here, you ignorant girl," she says.
Still, I do not move. Then Mumtaz flies at me. She grabs me by the hair and drags me across the room. She flings me onto the bed next to the old man, and then he is on top of me, holding me down with the strength of 10 men.
He kisses me with lips that are slack and wet and taste of onions. His teeth dig into my lower lip. Underneath the weight of him, I cannot see or move or breathe. He fumbles with his pants, forces my legs apart, and I can feel him pushing himself between my thighs. I gasp for air and kick and squirm. He thrusts his tongue into my mouth, and I bite down with all my might. He cries out, "Ugh!" and I am running, running down the hall, past the other girls, losing my fancy city shoes along the way, until I am back in the room where I started, pulling my old clothes out of my bundle. Sold. I am wiping the makeup off my face when the dark-skinned girl comes in. "What do you think you're doing?" she says. "I'm going home." Her tear-shaped eyes grow dark. "There is a mistake," I tell her. "I'm here to work as a maid for a rich lady." "Is that what you were told?" Then Mumtaz arrives at the door, huffing, her mango face pink with anger. "What do you think you're doing?" she says. "Leaving," I say. "I'm going home." Mumtaz laughs. "Home," she says. "And how would you get there?" "I don't know." "Do you know the way home?" she says. "Do you have money for the train? Do you speak the language here? Do you even have any idea where you are?" My heart is pounding like the drumming of a monsoon rain, and my shoulders are shaking as if I had a great chill. "You ignorant hill girl," she says. "You don't know anything, do you?" I wrap my arms around myself and grip with all my might, but the trembling will not stop. "Well then," Mumtaz says, pulling her record book out from her waistcloth. "Let me explain it to you." "You belong to me," she says, "and I paid a pretty sum for you too." She opens to a page in her book and points to the notation for 10,000 rupees. "You will take men to your room," she says, "and do whatever they ask of you. You will work here like the other girls until your debt is paid off." My head is spinning now, but I see only one thing, the number in her book. It warps and blurs, then fractures into bits that swim before my eyes. I fight back tears and find my voice. "But Auntie Bimla said..." "Your auntie," she scoffs, "works for me." I understand it all now. I blink back the tears in my eyes. I ball my hands into fists. I will not do this dirty business. I will wait until dark and escape from Mumtaz and her happiness house.
"Shahana!"
Mumtaz snaps her fingers and the dark-skinned girl hands her a pair of scissors. This Shahana leans close and whispers to me, "It will go easier on you if you hold still." There is a slicing sound, and a clump of my hair falls to the floor. I cry out and try to break free, but Shahana has hold of me. Mumtaz draws back, the jaw of the scissors poised at my neck.
"Hold still," she says, her teeth clenched, "or I'll slice your throat."
I look at Shahana. Her eyes are wide with fear. I stay very still, looking at the girl in the silver glass. Soon she has the shorn head of a disgraced woman and a face of stone.
"Try to escape with that head of hair," Mumtaz says, "and they'll bring you right back here."
And then they are gone, leaving me alone in the locked-in room. I pound on the door. I howl like an animal. I pray. I pace the room. I kick the door. But I do not cry. 3 days and 3 nights. Each day 1,000 people pass below my window. Children on their way to school, mothers hurrying home from the market, rickshaw pullers, vegetable sellers, street sweepers and alms seekers. Not one looks up. Each morning and evening Mumtaz comes, beats me with a leather strap and locks the door behind her. And each night I dream that Amma and I are sitting outside our hut, looking down the mountain at the festival lights, and she is twining my hair into long, dark braids. What's left? Tonight, when Mumtaz comes to my room,
She sees that her strap has left raw sores on my back and neck, my arms and legs. So she hits me on the soles of my feet. Hunger. Tonight, when Mumtaz comes and unlocks the door, she sees there is no part of me unmarked by her strap. Now will you agree to be with men? I shake my head. And so she says that she will starve me until I submit. What she does not realize is that I already know hunger. I know how your stomach gnaws on itself, searching for something to fill it. I know how your insides keep moving, unwilling to believe they are empty. I also know how to swallow your spit and pretend that it is soup. How to close your nose to the scent of another family's supper fire. And how to tie your waistcloth so tight that, at least for a few hours, you can fool your belly into thinking it's full. Mumtaz, with her doughy waist and fat mango face, doesn't know the match she's met in me. What I don't do. I don't pay attention to cries of the peanut vendor under my window. I don't let myself smell the onions frying in the kitchen below, or pay heed to the chatter of the girls as they head past my door to the midday meal. I don't listen for the footsteps of the street boy who brings afternoon tea in a wire caddy. I don't permit myself to smell the aroma of the bowl of curried rice that Mumtaz passes under my nose, or take notice of the churning of my stomach. Even in my sleep, I don't allow myself to dream of even a single roti. After 5 days of no food and water, I don't even dream. A cup of tea. I have grown to dread one sound more than any other, the rasping of the key in the lock, which means that Mumtaz has arrived with her strap and her taunts. And so I am in the corner of the locked-in room, my face to the wall, when the door opens. It is Shahana, the girl with the nut-brown skin, holding a cup of tea. She guides the cup to my mouth and talks softly. "Take it," she says. "Your lips are cracked." I sip, unwilling at first to let on how badly I want it, then I gulp it down greedily. "Slow down," she says, gently prying the cup from my hand. "If you go too fast, you will retch." I do as she says, but soon, too soon, the cup is empty. Shahana reaches out and runs a gentle hand over my head. "Your hair is already starting to grow back," she says. I try to speak, but there is no voice in my throat after all these days with no one to talk to. I want to tell this kind, dark-skinned girl about all the things I don't do. That I don't think about my parched lips or my shorn hair. That I don't look in the mirror. But the words won't come. "Mumtaz will let you live," she says, "if you do as she says." I turn my back to her and look out the window. 2 schoolgirls in crisp blue uniforms skip by on the street below, holding hands. "I've been out there," Shahana says, "and I can tell you that it's not so bad here." I am wary, knowing now how these city people cannot be believed. "It's true," she says. "Out there, you're no better than a dog." She points to a mongrel that has stopped to nose through a ditch full of human waste. "Here at least we have a bed and food and clothes." She pauses. I shake my head. "No," I hear myself say in a ragged voice. "I will not do this disgraceful thing." Shahana sighs. "She will only sell you to another place, just like this." She moves toward the door. Inside, I am begging her not to go, not to leave me alone watching the world go by outside my locked-in room. But on the outside, I am blank. I have already learned from these city people. From the ones who turned a blind eye to the legless beggar boy, from the ones who shuffle through this city of the dead with their eyes empty. "You are safe here, only if you do not show how frightened you are." After Shahana's visit, no one comes to my room. and I wonder if a day and a night have passed, or 2 days and nights, or a dozen days and nights. A pronouncement. One day, Mantas comes to my door without her strap. "I have decided to let you live," she says. Then she is gone, leaving me to ponder what will happen next. A cup of lassi. A little while later, the aging bird girl is standing at my door, holding out a cup of lassi, the sweet yogurt drink Amma gave me when I was sick. I take the glass with shaking hands. The drink is sweet and cool and tastes of mango. The girl takes the cup from me, but she remains watching me. After a few minutes, I feel odd, and soon her image is fading in and out like lantern light. I squint, and there are two of her. I blink, and she is gone. My arms and legs become distant things, their movements slow and liquid. Soon the sounds from the bazaar below bleed into one another, a soup of bleating horns and snarling engines. I try to think, but my thoughts keep collapsing or turning sideways or lapping circles around themselves. I begin to understand dimly that the lassi must have had some strange poison in it when Mumtaz steps into the room. After that, I don't understand anything. Lucky to be with Habib. A man with lips like a fish comes into my room and says,
"You're lucky to be with Habib."
He is squeezing my breast with his hand like someone shopping for a melon. I try to push him away, but my arm, stone heavy from the lassi, doesn't move.
"You're lucky," he says, "that Habib is your first one."
I close my eyes. The room pitches this way and that.
"You can tell the others that it was Habib," he says.
I open my eyes, watch him squeeze my other breast and wonder, who is this Habib he keeps talking about?
"If this is really your first time," he says, "old Mumtaz is a tricky one."
He unbuckles his belt.
"Once before, she sold Habib used goods."
The fish lips man removes my dress. I wait for myself to protest, but nothing happens.
"Habib," he says, "Habib is good with the ladies."
Then he is on top of me, and something hot and insistent is between my legs. He grunts and struggles, trying to fit himself inside me. With a sudden thrust, I am torn in two.
"Oh, yes," he says, panting. "Habib is good in bed."
I hear, coming from a distance, a steady thud, 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 and register that this is the sound of a headboard hitting a wall. After a while, I don't know how long, another sound interrupts the rhythmic thud of the headboard. I know this noise from somewhere. I work very hard to make it out. Finally, I identify it. It is the muffled sound of sobbing. Habib rolls off me. Then I understand. I was the person crying. One of them. I awake, stiff and sore. I have no idea of the time, although I suppose from the buzzing of the electric sun on the ceiling that it is the evening of the next day. My head throbs, my mouth is parched. I stand on shaky legs, then collapse on the bare floor, the pain between my legs like a searing coil. I grab the bedsheet, struggle to my feet, and make my way to the little table where someone has left a glass of water. Then I catch sight of a girl in the mirror. She has blackened tiger eyes and bleary chili pepper lips. She looks back at me full of sadness and scorn and says, "You have become one of them." Twilight. In the days that follow, many people come to my room. Some are real, some are not. Mumtaz appears each day at dusk and forces a cup of lassi between my clenched jaws. Shahana comes each morning with a cup of water and face of pity. They are real, of that I have no doubt. In the endless twilight after the lassi and before the morning, Others come. My stepfather appears, wearing his big shoulders coat and city hat, puffing on a cigarette. Then Bajai Sita is standing at the foot of the bed, locked in gossip with the headman's wife. And sometimes Auntie Bimla comes, her eyes glinting like new coins. They seem real, but I know that they are not. In between, men come. They crush my bones with their weight. They split me open. Then they disappear. I cannot tell which of the things they do to me are real and which are nightmares. I decide to think that it is all a nightmare, because if what is happening is real, it is unbearable. Hurt. I hurt. I am torn and bleeding where the men have been. I pray to the gods to make the hurting go away. To make the burning and the aching and the bleeding stop. Music and laughter come from the room next door. Horns and shouting come from the street below. No one can hear me, not even the gods. Between twilights. Sometimes between the twilights I unwrap my bundle from home and bury my face in the fabric of my old skirt. I inhale deeply, drinking in the scent of mountain sunshine, a warmth that smells of freshly turned soil and clean laundry baking in the sun. I breathe in a cool Himalayan breeze and the woodsy tang of a cooking fire, a smell that crackles with the promise of warm tea and fresh roti. Then I can get by until the next twilight. What you hear? Before it starts, you hear a zipper baring its teeth, perhaps the sound of a shoe being kicked aside in haste, the wincing of the mattress. Once it starts, you may hear the sound of horns bleating in the street below, the peanut vendor hawking his treats, or the pock of a rubber ball as the children shout and play in the schoolyard nearby. But if you are lucky, or if you work hard at it, you hear nothing. Nothing, perhaps, but the clicking of the fan overhead, the steady ticking away of seconds until it is over. Until it starts again. The danger of protection. One day Shahana comes to my room, bearing a cup of tea and a leftover heel of bread. She slips a small plastic package into my hand. "Don't let Mumtaz see this," she whispers. "What is it?" I ask. She checks to make sure no one can hear. "A condom." I don't understand what this condom is and why it must be kept so secret. Shahana explains. "Ask the men to use it so that you do not get a disease," she says. "Most of them will say no. They will threaten to go somewhere else if you insist." I nod. Shahana turns to lock the door. "Do not insist," Shahana says, "or Mumtaz will beat you half to death." A bucket of water. There is a bucket of water next to my bed. But no matter how often I wash and scrub and wash and scrub, I cannot seem to rinse the men from my body. Counting. The season has changed. I only know this because the people outside my window have begun to shed their sweaters, and still I am locked in this room. The lassi has made my brain too hazy to keep track of how many men have been here. I do not know how much they pay. All I know is that each time one leaves, my debt to Mumtaz grows a little smaller. A handful of fog. I remember the velvet of Tali's pink nose, the ghostly fragrance of night flowers, the rough-edged notch in the school bench, the sunset red of Nepali dirt, the tinkling music of Amma's earrings, the silver-white sheen of the mountain in moonlight. At first, these recollections came unbidden. Soon, though, I had to work to recall them. But eventually, with much tracing and retracing, they became threadbare, thin as the blanket on my bed,
until one day my heart nearly stopped when I could not summon them up. Now I practice these memories each morning and night, the way my teacher taught me to drill my maths. Still, there is one image that I cannot forget, no matter how I try. One stubborn memory that nudges the others out of my head. Amma's face as she imagined the comfort of a tin roof. Trying to remember, I have learned, is like trying to clutch a handful of fog. Trying to forget, like trying to hold back the monsoon. Changes. One afternoon, Mumtaz comes to the door and tells me to gather up my things. "Now that you are no longer a virgin," she says, "I cannot fetch a good price for you.